So I'd like to start off today by echoing a common observation that many of us have either experienced or thought to ourselves. And that's the thought that bad things happen. So during the course of a normal lifespan, we all encounter difficulty, whether it's mourning the loss of a loved one, enduring events of violence, as well as life-threatening events. These events can be deeply distressing and even debilitating. And when we think of trauma, we think of, repercussions that span many, many years afterwards. So before we begin today, I'd like to do a thought exercise with you and ask you to think about a time in your life that was a very difficult event. Now, as you recall this difficult and perhaps even traumatic event, I'd like you to think about how you would describe what that event was. So what triggered or elicited a particular emotional reaction? How was that emotional reaction? How did you react to the difficult event? How was that feeling in your body? And how long did it last for? So I'd like you to take a moment and think about it. You can pause the video. And when you're done thinking about it and recalling it as vividly as possible, I'd like you to resume the video. Because what we're going to do today is just think about how we cope with trauma and the different trajectories people take when they cope well with trauma and when we struggle and have difficulty coping with traumatic and difficult life events. This is going to begin our first part of a three-part series on emotional health. Today we'll be starting with resilience, really asking this question: is it really true that what doesn't kill you actually can make you stronger? We'll be doing it as follows. So our roadmap today will start with the concept of what we have traditionally studied and known in the field of trauma and emotional health. Then we'll turn to this concept of resilience, which seems to be a somewhat lighter side of how people respond to and cope with trauma, concluding with our takeaway questions and expert interview. So let's begin with trauma and how it relates to our emotional health. So, traditionally, the emphasis on trauma and emotional health was really assessing how people frequently fail to cope with trauma. And this was really in the realm of clinical psychology or looking at the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. It was really looking at psychopathological responses to trauma. So here the focus was often on what we think of as extreme responses to trauma. So examples include chronic grief, depression, and a very classic example of the kinds of difficulties people have when confronting traumatic life experiences is PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder. So if we look into the DSM and open it up, we see that the criteria for post-traumatic stress disorder includes 1, encountering a stressor, being exposed to a traumatic event; 2, having some intrusive recollection of the trauma that is persistently re-experienced even after the event has absolved; 3rd is a sort of avoidant or numbing style, so avoiding things that might remind you of that particular trauma, or feeling just a general sense of what people describe as emotionally numb. You also see physiological hyperarousal, and this duration is really prolonged, so it must last at least 1 month continuously and cause significant impairment across social, occupational, or other important areas of functioning. So again, the original emphasis when we think about trauma has been on how people fail to cope well with trauma and the kinds of difficulties that are encapsulated in an individual who's having trouble coping with a traumatic life event, such as in the case of PTSD. Now, although this is very important and it helps us develop treatments to alleviate suffering among individuals suffering from either PTSD, depression, or chronic grief, for example, the emphasis really is on a certain kind of slice of the population. So what we're really getting is an emphasis on psychopathology or the ways in which people don't cope well with trauma. So this leads to a sampling bias, right? And really begs the question of, well, what about the rest of the population? How do other people cope with trauma who don't suffer these same kinds of symptoms and for an extreme duration of time? So this is work done by George Bonanno and colleagues, where they've really tried to map out different trajectories of responding to traumatic events. So here you can see disruption in functioning on the left side, followed by a traumatic event, and looking at the ways people respond even 1 year and 2 years after the event. So what we see first is the kind of response that we typically characterize and associate with psychopathology, PTSD, for example, right? However, and what we see here is there's a traumatic event and there's some disruption in functioning when the event occurs, and it persists at a relatively stable high level even up to 2 years after the event. Now, what's important to think about here is this is just one way a person can respond to a traumatic event. By contrast, if you look here, this is what's thought of as the normative or average response. So although you do see a disruption in functioning when the initial event occurs, what you notice is over time a decrease in functional impairment, you know, 1 and 2 years later. So the important point to think about here is that although some people respond this way and have, you know, long-standing impairment, most people don't. Most people seem to suffer some disruption, but that it absolves over time. And who is this slice of the population? What is this normative or average response to, you know, encountering a traumatic event, right? So we can take this a step further as well and look at, starting with what we had before, this kind of psychopathological or what's thought of as a chronic response to stressors. So this is 5 to 30% of the population. Then we can look at what we think of as recovery. So these are the two lines we saw originally. So recovery is sort of the normative response, 15 to 25% of the population. And what you see here in white and yellow are two other groups of people. You have people who have a delayed response to trauma, so this is 0 to 15% of the population, and people who are resilient here at the bottom. Now what's interesting, if you focus here on the bottom of resilience, what you're seeing is that people are not showing a large increase in disruption and functioning to the traumatic event, and this remains relatively stable over time. And what's really interesting here, if you pay attention, the resilient group at the bottom is the largest percent of the population. So most people respond this way. So this suggests, one, that we may be neglecting very important individual variability in how we typically study trauma. There's many different trajectories, not just this chronic heightened level of functional impairment that we see in cases of psychopathology, PTSD, chronic grief, etc. And it also suggests that if we only focus on this top segment here, we're likely to generate misleading conclusions about how everyone in the world responds to trauma if we're focusing on just this one extreme subset of the population. So although some people may suffer chronic and severe impairment following trauma, many people don't, and in fact it seems that most people don't. So this begs the question of how do most of the people in the population, or how do most of us respond to trauma? How do most of us recover from trauma? How do we become resilient, in other words? So what we're really looking at here then is, so we draw these all lines here all in gray. The part that we're really focusing on here again is this yellow line, the resilient line. And again, really begging the question of what is resiliency? So now what I want to do is turn to resiliency and really focus on what we might think of as this lighter side of coping with trauma. So what's interesting here from this graph, and the takeaway question we'll walk through, is that we are amazingly resilient creatures. So if we think of those two trajectories we saw earlier, the yellow line at the bottom, the resilient line, and the red line at the top, that kind of chronic and persistent functional impairment associated with psychopathology, what we see, and this is work largely done by George Bonanno and colleagues, is that in response to a large variety of traumas, bereavement, terrorist attacks, traumatic injury, breast cancer surgery, job loss, divorce, birth of a child, combat deployment, and even spinal cord lesion, what you see by and large is that if you look at the percentage of people and you categorize them into these different groups, the majority of people show a resilient type of response course over time in response to these different traumatic events, above and beyond that compared to a more chronic and persistent course. So this just suggests that we are amazingly resilient, and in fact profoundly resilient in response to things that seem like they would be absolutely incapacitating, things that we can't imagine getting over, terrorist attacks, spinal cord injuries, but yet most of us do. We seem to bounce back from traumas and do so in a way that seems to span all different kinds of domains. So how are we these amazingly, profoundly resilient human beings? So let's start by defining what resiliency is. So we talked about the idea of bouncing back from trauma. So its resiliency has been defined, on the one hand, as an individual's tendency to cope with stress and adversity. And a really important component of resilience, and I always think of a bouncing ball, because it's really about responding to stress and adversity by rebounding or bouncing back. that even though there may be some temporary disruption in an individual's functioning, what you're seeing is that after the event, they do bounce back to their baseline levels of functioning. And when we think of resiliency and adjustment, there's a really important couple take-home points to think about. So resiliency and adjustment, as you can see here. So resiliency is associated with an absence of symptoms and reported psychological distress, associated with an increased level of mental health and functioning, as associated with increased positive adjustment, as rated by close friends and relatives. And finally, resilience is associated with increased positive experiences, including positive images of the self, as well as images of comfort. So what we're seeing is that resiliency across many domains of functioning is predicting positive adjustment. So we know that resiliency promotes adaptive adjustment in response to trauma. But then this begs the question, right? Why are some people more resilient than others? So we know that many of us are resilient in response to stressors, but why are some more resilient than others? Now, some caveats before we really delve into this question is that, you know, this is a heterogeneous category. We're talking about different people with different experiences and different backgrounds, and there's likely many different routes to the same end. So many different ways in which someone can be resilient or become resilient. And there's often multiple and sometimes unexpected predictors. That being said, let me show you a glimpse of the literature that highlights different kinds of factors that promote and predict why some people may be more resilient than others. So, if we look at factors that are related to pre-event, so these are individual difference factors before the trauma has occurred that predict increased resiliency when the trauma unfolds. So we look at, there's factors such as the individual's age and gender, how prepared they are for the trauma, sort of how do they have the appropriate mobilization resources in play, if it's something that they can predict maybe, such as an earthquake or a storm. Have they had prior exposure to that particular type of trauma? Do they have the economic resources to effectively combat the trauma and bounce back from it? And interestingly, do they have beliefs that are often predictive of resiliency, such as acceptance of death or a sense of greater justice in the world? Do they have increased social support, cognitive styles like being more optimistic or feeling that they're more self-efficacious in the world? These are a list of factors that we know promote greater resilience that individuals may possess or not before a trauma occurs. Now, what about factors that are associated with resilience after the traumatic event has occurred? And we think of these as post-event factors. Now, some of these factors include and that predict often difficulty or decreased resilience include a loss of adequate resources to cope with the trauma. They have a less deep sense of searching for meaning in the trauma. So they're not trying to sort of find some greater meaning out of the event. They worry more, ruminate more. They have increased ongoing stress, fewer coping skills, more difficulty cognitively reappraising, which we talked about as one of the core emotion regulation strategies discussed earlier in the course, decreased positive emotion, and trouble engaging what we think of as emotional flexibility. So a decreased level of all of these factors here would predict worse resiliency, whereas a higher degree of reappraisal, coping, positive emotional flexibility would predict increased resilience after the traumatic event has occurred. What are some features that help answer this question too as to why are some individuals more resilient than others? Well, there's been work by George Bonanno and colleagues that have talked about this idea of having a flexible use of regulatory strategies and behaviors. And he talks about three central components that help predict resiliency. So one of them he calls context sensitivity, the second is repertoire, and the third is the use of feedback from others. Now I'm going to go through the first two here and really flesh out what he's talking about when he says that, you know, an important feature of resiliency is having context sensitivity as well as a repertoire. So let's think about context sensitivity. So what George Bonanno is talking about here when he defines context sensitivity is this idea of really trying to match your regulatory behavior to the situational demand. So that may be reappraising when the time is right, or suppressing your outward displays of emotion if that's what the situation calls for. So what he's really trying to talk about, and I think about this as sort of puzzle pieces fitting together, is really fitting the kinds of behaviors, the kinds of emotions, the kinds of regulatory strategies you use to that particular context. So really kind of fine-tuning and honing or having your responses be sensitive to whatever the situational demands or whatever the context calls for. So this is what he talks about when he talks about context sensitivity. What we see interestingly is individuals who report increased depression, both chronically and following traumatic life events, don't have context sensitive responses. They seem to show the same rigid pattern of emotional responses regardless of the event in front of them, regardless of the environmental situation. So really being flexible, really trying to fit and hone your emotional behaviors to the environment is one of the most central factors, George Bonanno would argue, that helps promote resiliency. The other one is this notion of repertoire, right? So here he talks about the idea of a toolbox, right? So you want to have not just one kind of response or one kind of strategy that you use every time you encounter a trauma, right? So he says you want to have a wide toolbox of possible regulatory behaviors and strategies. And he would say in this toolbox that no one tool is going to fit every situation. That is, not all strategies to cope with trauma are either inherently good or bad. So earlier on in the course, we talked about suppression as an emotion regulation strategy that's associated with inhibiting outward displays of emotion in the face. And we talked about this in light of James Gross's work, finding that people who tend to use suppression on a regular basis tend to be associated with greater negative affect, lower positive affect, and overall lower well-being. What one caveat in this research is that it may suggest that suppression's all bad, that it's always a maladaptive type of regulatory behavior. Well, George Bonanno's work has actually suggested that suppression is not always bad, right? And it's more about when you exhibit suppression that suggests whether or not it's going to ultimately be in your favor to suppress your expressions or not. So he would say that really the expression of suppression, so to speak, in other words, whether you're going to inhibit your emotions, suppress them, or let them out and express them, is not as important as whether or not you have, he would say in quotes, the ability to flexibly enhance or suppress emotional expression in accord with the situational demands. So he would say that what this really requires here is a repertoire that consists of what he calls expressive flexibility, as well as positive emotion signaling. And I'll walk through each of these right now. So when it comes to expressive flexibility, George Bonanno and colleagues argue this is incredibly important. So what they did to study expressive flexibility was to design an experimental study where they asked participants to either try to enhance or amplify their emotional responses or suppress them or dampen them. And he did this among adults who had lost their spouse 1.5 to 3 years earlier, compared to married adults who had not lost their spouse. And among the adults who had lost their spouse, he broke them into two groups. One of them he called the complicated grief group, who exhibited difficulty following the loss of the spouse and unresolved grief, as well as those who were relatively asymptomatic following the bereavement of their spouse. Now here's what he found. So you can see the married group in white, the asymptomatic bereaved group in gray, and the complicated grief group in red. So what he found is that bereaved adults who were suffering from complicated grief exhibited a decreased ability to enhance their emotions. So you can see the red bar on the left is lower than the gray and white bar compared to the other two groups. And that's for enhancement. So they had a harder time trying to enhance their emotional expressions. Interestingly, the complicated grief group in red also showed difficulty suppressing their emotions as well. So when they were asked to suppress their emotions, they did a much poorer job compared to the other two groups as well. When they were trying to bring their emotions down, you can actually see they showed more emotional expressivity compared to the married and asymptomatic bereaved group. So this suggests that it's not about whether you suppress or whether you express your emotions, but it suggests that the ability to flexibly move your emotional expressions up and down, almost like having a really flexible lever in your emotional repertoire, signals something really important and a key factor that's related to the ability to be resilient in the face of trauma and loss. And I also talked about positive emotional signaling as a really important factor that Bonanno argues is key in coping with trauma and a factor related to increased resilience. So this is actually something we talked about earlier in the course when we were talking about the function of laughter. And I want to review it now in light of this idea that positive emotional signaling may also help us cope better with trauma. So as you remember, George Bonanno and Dacher Keltner conducted a study looking at laughter following bereavement and suggesting that it predicts better outcomes. So in this study, they had 45 adults come into the laboratory whose spouse had recently died in the past 6 months. And here they tried to address the question systematically of whether or not laughter indeed promotes healing from this absolutely devastating loss of one's partner. They conducted an interview with spouses where they asked them to tell me about your relationship with your deceased partner. And the participant had 6 minutes to share this verbal narrative in response to this question. And what they did is they then videotaped and coded expressions of laughter during this narrative and found that those widows who are able to laugh when telling them about the relationship with their deceased partner predict reduced levels of grief, as you can see here, at 14 and 15 months post-loss. So this is suggesting that something about signaling positive emotion in the face may also help people take almost a sort of mental vacation from grief and suffering and allow them to rebound back and become resilient, even 1 to 2 years later. So in sum, we know that bad things happen, right? And some people become very severely distressed and struggle, while others seem to be generally okay. And there's multiple and unexpected predictors of who does and who doesn't do well. And there's no one predictor that explains it all. It's a mix of social, economic, personality, and coping resources, and maybe even a bit of luck. But most of us seem to be able to bounce back and seem to have some degree of resiliency in us. And what's really important when we think about the study of human emotion is that what predicts who and who are not resilient seems to relate to some key emotional factors. And this includes being flexible about our emotions when we experience them and when we express them, whether we increase or decrease them, as well as having the ability to signal positive emotions to others in the face of trauma and in resolving trauma and coping with it in the aftermath. So with that, I'd like to now turn to our takeaway questions. First, how would you characterize the earlier, more clinically focused approaches to understanding trauma from a DSM clinical science perspective? Second, what is the distinction between resilient and chronic responses to trauma? So think about the different types of graphs we showed, showing the longitudinal trajectories of different response styles to trauma. And finally, how would you define what resiliency is? And what are some of the key features that were discussed by George Bonanno and colleagues? I'll now turn to our Experts in Emotion interview series. So, for Experts in Emotion interview, we'll be speaking with Dr. George Bonanno on emotion and resilience. Dr. Bonanno is a professor of clinical psychology and director of the Loss, Trauma, and Emotion Lab in the Department of Counseling and Clinical Psychology at Teachers College, Columbia University. He received his PhD from Yale University in 1991 and has been a visiting professor at the University of Hong Kong and in Italy. Professor Bonanno's interests center on the question of how human beings cope with loss, trauma, and other forms of extreme adversity, with an emphasis on resilience as well as the salutary role of emotion regulatory processes. His recent empirical and theoretical work has focused on defining and documenting resilience in the face of loss or potentially traumatic events. This includes disaster, the death of loved ones, terrorist attacks, bioepidemics, traumatic injury, and life-threatening injuries and medical events. He also focuses on identifying the range of psychological and contextual variables that predict both psychopathological as well as resilient outcomes, as well as other patterns of outcomes, including gradual recovery and delayed reactions. Dr. Bonanno's work has been funded by the National Institutes of Health, the National Science Foundation, and the Rockefeller Foundation, and featured in various print, television, and radio media, including the New York Times, Science News, Scientific American, Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post, Time, Newsweek, CNN, 2020, and NPR. He's also co-edited the book Emotion, Current Issues and Future Directions, and recently authored The Other Side of Sadness, What the New Science of Bereavement Can Tell Us About Life After Loss. So I now turn to our Experts in Emotion interview with Dr. George Bonanno.